Now, before we go on with our gradual path of training and in particular aspects connected with vipassana, namely insight, let us take a look at satipatthana itself. What we're practicing here is satipatthana, namely the establishments of mindfulness, and as a meditator of this particular practice, you need to know some of the very basic meditation instructions as given in the texts themselves. Now, the references to satipatthana can be found, of course, in the long or the great discourse on the establishments of mindfulness, Mahasatipatthana Sutta, in the Digha Nikaya, the long discourses of the Buddha, but they can also be found in the Satipatthana Sutta, namely from the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length discourses of the Buddha, and then there's a pretty comprehensive collection of discourses on satipatthana in the Samyutta Nikaya, the connected discourses of the Buddha. And apart from those, we find certain shorter and longer discourses on sati in the Anguttara Nikaya, and then also in the Patthisambhida, the Magga, the path of the path of purification, and the Visuddhimagga itself also contains plenty of instructions on satipatthana, and expositions on satipatthana can furthermore be found in the Chinese and Sanskrit versions of the Buddhist texts. Now, when we look at the Satipatthana Sutta from the Majjhima Nikaya, now then, from a structural point of view, then there's at first, or it's composed in the following way. The first part consists of an introduction in which the Buddha mentions where he gave this talk, namely in the land of the Kurus. And there is the prologue in which the Buddha mostly and boldly declares the seven benefits to this practice, and then he goes on to explain those in brief, those four establishments of mindfulness, and also mentioning a couple of mental factors that need to accompany mindfulness, namely clear comprehension, as we've seen already, and furthermore ardhāpi, namely ardent energy. And then, the Buddha explains those four establishments one by one. The four establishments of mindfulness are the establishment of, or is the mindful contemplation of the body or bodily phenomena, bodily formations, and then as number two, mindful contemplation of feelings, namely pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral feelings. And by feelings we don't mean emotions, but rather the affective quality of an object. And then we have cittanupassana satipatthana, which is mindful contemplation of the mind, of citta. And then we have mindful contemplation of dhammas, dhamma nupassana satipatthana. And the first contemplation, namely that of Pratna, the body can or is then further broken down into mindful contemplation of breathing, of postures, of activities, of anatomical parts of the body, of elements, and then a corpse in decay. And feelings are not further subdivided, and then we have mindfulness of mind. So there's 16 elements or points there, which in one of the future Dhamma talks we will deal with. And then we have mindfulness, the mindful contemplation of Dhammas. And a number of aspects come under this, namely the five hindrances, the five aggregates, then the six sense spheres, the enlightenment, seven enlightenment factors, and then the four noble truths. And then the concluding portion, or the ending, the end of the Satipatthana Sutta consists in three parts, namely in a prediction part, predicting how long it may take a meditator to realize the Dhamma, and then a repetition of the statement of the seven benefits that can be derived from the Satipatthana meditation, and finally comes the conclusion. So that's just the basic structure of the sutta. And the Buddha is in general very systematic when it comes to the arrangement of his discourses. Once one has seen the structure, then it's almost predictable what the next point is going to be. Now, so today we will focus mostly on the contemplation of the body, kaya, upasana, satipatthana. And as given a few moments ago, it consists of mindfulness of breathing, of bodily postures, of clear comprehension of activities, and this we have actually dealt with already to some extent under the topic of clear comprehension, and, or under the heading. And then there's the contemplation of the parts of the body, such as the head hair, the body hair, and then the teeth, and the fingernails, toenails, and so on. And then the contemplation of the four elements, and the symmetry contemplations. Now, in the Mahasi approach to Satipatthana meditation, not all of these six different aspects come up. And the Venerable Mahasi Sayadaw has limited his interpretation of the contemplation of the body to a certain aspect. So, the observation of, or mindful contemplation of the rising and falling movement of the abdomen, what do you think? Under which of these contemplations does it come? Does it come under breathing, or does it come under symmetry contemplations, or under which heading does it come? The body. Yes, the body. Can you be, what do you mean by body? It's parts of the body or postures?
Neither of those.
Oh, neither of those. Then, if neither of those, then what?
Breathing.
Ah, here comes the breathing. And, well, one is tempted to see it this way. However, it's actually not the case. Now, when we look at it in history, then, in Venerable Mahasi Sayadaw, of Burma first propagated this method of, or this way of meditation. Now then the big question arose, under which heading present this rising, for observation of the rising and falling, or using the rising and falling movement of the abdomen as the primary object. And back then, and that was in the late 40s, 1940s, there was big discussions going on, and also some exchange of views with some Sri Lankan Buddhist scholars and monastics. And so eventually, the Venerable Mahasi Sayadaw then explained that said that the observation of the rising and falling movement of the abdomen comes under mindful contemplation of elements, namely the dhatus. And so the dhatus are, they make up what we call a body. And among the so-called four elements, we have the earth element, or in other words, the element of solidity, covering hardness, the whole range from hardness to softness, and from roughness to smoothness. And then we also have the wind element, which stands for motion. And then we have the temperature element, or fire element, which stands for various temperatures, so covering the whole range from heat to warmth, and to cool to cold. And then we have the water element, which stands for cohesion or fluidity. And so among the four elements, under which heading does the contemplation of the rising falling fall? The wind element, yes, is correct. And since when we breathe in, the abdomen will undergo a certain motion, and as we breathe out, again there will be some movement there, there will be a contraction, and so this has to do with the wind element, or with the element of motion or movement. And so one is tempted to think that the observation of the rise and fall comes under the contemplation of breathing, but actually it belongs better under the wind element as part of the four elements. Now, in the Mahasi tradition of Satipatthana, we practice mostly mindfulness of bodily postures, so mindfulness during standing, and or during walking, during standing, and then during sitting and lying. However, among those four postures, which are the ones that are mostly recommended, especially during intensive retreats? Huh? Do we start with lying meditation? Would be nice if it would be that way. This might be something for the elderly, but not for us. And then the Venerable Mahasi Sayadaw, what do you think? Did he include much the standing posture? know, to some extent, to a limited extent, you know, for instance, as part of the, you know, walking, you know, meditation when, you know, standing and before, you know, turning around. However, there have been people, actually, well-known monastics such as Togu Sayadaw, famous disciple of Mahasi Sayadaw himself, who practiced in the standing posture for long, long hours. And the story is that Venerable Togu Sayadaw ordained only during the later part of his life, when he was maybe 60 or 70. And at that time, he was suffering from a number of different illnesses. And owing to his bad health condition, or poor health, he could not practice in the sitting posture. And so the Venerable Mahasi Sayadaw recommended that he do standing or meditation in standing, in the standing posture, which Togu Sayadaw did. And he found that the longer he would stand, the more he would go and get into his practice, and even his health would improve. And later on, Togu Sayadaw developed a system of mindfulness meditation that very much emphasizes long sessions of sitting meditation, of walking meditation. So hours, like 7, 8, 9, 10 hours of just walking meditation non-stop. And then the same thing in standing meditation, and the same thing in lying meditation. And well, you might think lying for long stretches like 10 hours must be wonderful, then I can go off sleeping. However, if one is really mindful and has to observe all the different sensations that occur in the back or on the side, then it's not necessarily all that pleasant. Anyway, so this is just for general knowledge. And so, in the Mahasi tradition, we practice mindfulness of bodily postures, mostly sitting posture and then walking posture. And like I said, occasionally, as part of the walking, there's a little bit of standing meditation there. And I do recommend standing meditation, especially for those who suffer from strong sloth and torpor. And so then we also practice clear comprehension of activities. So when coming and going, and then when taking meals, and bending and stretching the limbs, and opening and closing the eyes, and brushing our teeth, and so on and so forth. And so the contemplation of the parts of the body we don't practice all that much, but definitely number 5, the contemplation of the 4 elements. And so what about the cemetery contemplations? Do we do this? Not really. Now, in general, we can say that this Kayanupassana Satipatthana is one out of those certain 4 establishments of mindfulness, and in essence, it's the same, or the essence of all 4 is the same, namely mindful contemplation of whatever predominant object arises in the body or in the mind. Now, when we look at these 4 establishments of mindfulness, starting with Kayanupassana Satipatthana, so mindful contemplation of the body, and then next is mentioned feelings, and then of the mind, and then of dhammas, there is a certain principle that lies behind the arrangement. And so what do you think is the principle here? Have they been arranged in random order, or is there a certain...
Unit of friendliness.
Pardon me?
User-friendliness.
Oh, user-friendliness. could you explain this?
Well, I think that my guess is, or my hunch is that the body is the easiest to observe.
Ah. And why is the body the easiest to observe?
The feelings, the minds, and the mental states operate much more quickly.
Ah. Good. And now, Rick, what you're saying is very good. And on top of this, the bodily formations or sensations are usually coarser, not just slower, but also coarser than feelings and than the mind objects and than Dhamma objects. And so The four satipatthanas are arranged by way of increasing refinement, namely going from gross bodily objects to increasingly refined objects. So when it comes to something like the mindful contemplation of consciousness, this is extremely refined, and it takes a lot of practice to do this or to see consciousness clearly. Now, when we actually undertake the practice of these four establishments of mindfulness, does it mean that we first practice exclusively kaya anupassana satipatthana, namely mindful contemplation of the body or bodily formations, and then, having done this to some extent, then we shift our focus onto feelings, and then, having done this for a while, and the teacher gives permission, then we move on to citta nupassana, and then finally to dhamma nupassana. Is this how it happens? What do you think?
I'm sorry, what were the last two categories in English?
Second last one is mindful contemplation of the mind, and the very last one is mindful contemplation of just dhammas. And the term is, it's a Pali term, and for the time being, let us leave it untranslated, because it covers certain many different aspects. No? So, then, how is this how we proceed? So first, exclusively we do kaya nupassana?
My sense is that one begins there, but that other things will arise.
Ah.
And that when they arise, one needs to note them, but then come back to the level at which one's working.
Okay, very good. So, indeed, Stephen, what you're saying is correct. Within one single sitting, it is quite likely that all four contemplations or four establishments of mindfulness will be or will occur. And now, to give you an explanation for this, or an example for this, we start out with a contemplation of the rising and falling. Rising and falling movement of the abdomen, and obviously this then comes under kaya nupassana satipatthana. So mindful contemplation of the body, and in particular the wind element, but also other elements. And then, as we persistently observe the different qualities of the rising and falling, we notice that it is accompanied by some feeling. So let's say there's a pleasant feeling there. And then we become aware of this pleasant feeling, we label it, we observe it, we know its nature. When this happens, while we're aware of the pleasant feeling, we are doing mindful contemplation of feelings, namely vedana nupassana satipatthana. And so, then as we keep observing, and as we are aware of this pleasant feeling, and it's really so pleasant in the mind, a sense of liking arises, and so the mind wants to experience more and more of it. In other words, greed is there. So greed becomes the predominant object of observation. Eventually we recognize what is happening, and we turn our mindfulness to it, And so then we observe this greed, and with this then it becomes mindful contemplation of the mind. So we realize we're aware of a mind that is associated with or consciousness associated with greed. And so, then, as we continue to practice, and we contemplate various objects as they arise, we realize after a while, well, not just greed has arisen, but also later on there's some aversion towards the pain that has arisen in the meantime, and after a while we find that we're overwhelmed by dullness of the mind, so sloth and torpor is there, and then we find after a while that some restlessness is there, and finally some skeptical doubts cross our mind, and so we contemplate leaving the retreat, even though there's no real reason for this. And then when we turn our awareness to these different mental states, eventually we get the point, these must be the five hindrances. So greed is there, aversion is there, sloth and torpor is there, restlessness and so maybe also some remorse, and skeptical doubt is there. And as such then it becomes mindful contemplation of Dhammas, namely the five hindrances, which is one group of teachings. So within one single sitting, all four of those satipatthanas can come up for observation. Now, let us take let us see what the Satipatthana Sutta has to say in terms of direct instruction regarding bodily postures, mindfulness of bodily postures. And I'm quoting from the Majjhima Nikaya in the Satipatthana Sutta there. When walking, one knows I am walking. When standing, one knows I am standing. When sitting, one knows I am sitting. When lying down, one knows I am lying down. Or one knows accordingly, however one's body is disposed. So, what we have here in this short paragraph on instructions on bodily contemplation of bodily postures, there's mention not just of the four postures, but in the last sentence, however one's body is disposed, one knows it. So if one assumes a posture, some intermediate posture that is neither neither walking, nor standing, nor sitting, nor lying down, one is still mindful of it. And this then means, this then covers postures such as the process of lying down, not quite being in the lying posture. And this then covers, for instance, the case of Venerable Ananda, the disciple and attendant of the Buddha for many years, who gained arahantship in which posture? Well, while he was actually lying on the bed, or getting into that posture? Getting into the lying posture, quite correct. So his head hadn't quite yet reached the pillow or the bed, and it is at that point that he gained full realization. Now, when it comes to to the contemplation of the postures, again they are arranged in a particular way, namely from walking to standing to sitting to lying. And the organizing principle here is, and I'm basing this on observations by Venerable Analayo in his book Satipatthana, the principle is from the more active walking to the more refined and passive posture of lying down. Now, in the Mahasi approach to Satipatthana, there is a tremendous emphasis on the continuity of one's mindfulness. Can you think of other traditions in Vipassana where this is not really the case? The jhanas, yes. So there, you do your sitting and then? Well, then you just get up and you walk around and take it easy. Or, give you another example. Well, in the Goenka tradition of Vipassana meditation, so much emphasis there is given to sitting meditation, and then after sitting, the meditators are encouraged to, be somewhat generally mindful, but definitely not to, and I clearly remember the instruction, not to walk around slowly like a snail would. Crawl around, and so that then shows there is less emphasis on walking meditation there. Now, the Venerable Mahasi Sayadaw very much trying to maintain, or very much trying to ensure that the mindfulness, the concentration, and also the wisdom developed and acquired during the sitting meditation does not get lost after the sitting meditation is over. So, just imagine a negative example. So, you sit there in meditation, you try really hard, and you give your very best to observe the rise and fall from moment to moment and other predominant objects, and then come forward, and then finally comes the bell, and you jump up, and then you run out of the meditation hall, and you start talking to your fellow meditators, and then you distract yourself by reading and by doing all sorts of things. Now, this would be helpful for your mindfulness and for your concentration and for your wisdom? Yes or no? Huh? Probably not. And now, if such a meditator then were to go back to the next sitting, he or she would have to start all over again. Or at least, the practice of one's mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom will have dropped off significantly, and in the next sitting one needs to develop it again. And so in the Mahasi tradition, the approach is different, and there's much attention being paid maintaining one's mindfulness from the sitting meditation and letting it carry over into the walking meditation. The same thing goes for the concentration, the same thing goes for the wisdom. And ideally, if one is not blowing it during the walking meditation through absent-mindedness or lack of restraint of the senses, then one's mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom will improve even further. And by the time the next sitting comes, one is in an even better state than at the end of the previous sitting. So then there's a clear progression from one sitting to, you know, the next walking, from the walking to, you know, the next sitting, and so on and so forth. And, you know, when that continuity of mindfulness is not quite assured, and then easily it will lead to the arising of which object? The doubt. Yes, the doubt and wandering mind, the doubt may very much then color the wandering mind. Now, when one contemplates the different postures, and in particular a change of postures, then this will have one major benefit, namely it will lead to a decrease in wandering mind, and also in distractions, and it will strengthen one's, as we've seen, one's mindfulness. So it is, frequently it happens that during this change of posture, or the transition from one posture to another, that the distractions come, the wandering mind comes in, distractions come in. And so when one focuses one's beam of attention onto those certain changes of posture, then there's less likelihood for the mind to wander off. Now, in general, we can say that a longer contemplation in the sitting posture will lead to a development of concentration, whereas a longer contemplation in the in the walking posture will lead to the strengthening of effort. And the reason for this is as follows. You see, in the walking meditation, a double or a twofold effort is required, namely the bodily effort to maintain an upright posture, not to lose one's balance and not to fall over, and secondly the mental effort to keep one's attention on the different sensations that are occurring during the walking. Now, whereas in the sitting meditation you need less of that bodily effort to maintain the sitting posture. Some effort will be necessary, of course, but not as much as during the walking. And so, during a longer sitting, since the body is not moving, there'll be less agitation in the mind, and as a result it is easier to develop concentration. So should you ever find that you're lacking in concentration, then one of the things you can do is simply opt for a longer sitting, and so this might help. In this connection also, what helps is to stay with one predominant object, such as a pain, for a longer period of time, and this will definitely sharpen or strengthen your concentration. Now, maybe this much regarding the original instruction on bodily postures and some notes on those instructions. Now, next, let us see what the Satipatthana Sutta has to say in terms of instructions on the mindful contemplation of elements, which is one of the aspects of the contemplation of the body. So, and I'm quoting again from the Satipatthana Sutta. A meditator reviews this same body, however it is placed, however disposed, as consisting of elements thus. In this body there are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, and the air element. So, what Satya, this certain instruction, then does is analyzing our particular part of our being in a different way, namely by way of the four primary elements, or the great elements, Maha, Bhuta, Dhatu, in the Pali scriptural language. So early on, our body was analyzed by way of posture, so walking, standing, sitting, lying. Now we take a closer look at the body under the aspect of the four elements. And this in Pali is known as Dhatu Vavatana. Dhatu means element, and Vavatana is analysis. And when a meditator, like all of you, keeps observing the predominant objects occurring in the body, and in particular under the aspect of the four elements, so the earth element, and then the fire element, the wind element, and the water element, and then what does this lead to? What's the benefit of this?
It sharpens concentration.
Yes, this is one aspect. But more important than this,
breaks down the barriers between your body and what's outside your body?
Yes. Okay, let me give you a hint. And I'll exaggerate a little bit. My body is so beautiful. Oh, my body is so strong. Oh, my body is so healthy. Oh, my body is so important. Everything turns around my body. My body needs to be dressed nicely, and it needs to be attractive. It needs to impress other people. Don't hit my body, because you're hitting my ego. So, when we then undertake this mindful contemplation of the body under the aspect of the four elements, then what do we realize? Huh?
It's true nature?
It's true nature in which sense?
Change.
Ah, change. Now we're getting there. And what else?
Dukkha.
Huh? Dukkha. Ah, anatta. So, anicca, dukkha, and anatta. So, for those who don't know these Pali technical expressions, anicca means impermanence, and dukkha means unsatisfactoriness, and anatta means absence of self or no self. And so, as non-meditators, we tend to be terribly attached to our body and preoccupied with our body, and always so concerned with the condition and well-being of our body. It's just unbelievable. We're really overdoing it. And so this contemplation of the four elements, and then helps us very much to bring about a major shift in our perception of the body. Sorry, of the body. And previously, we relate to the body as my body, or the body is identified with as I. So the body and the ego is the same thing. And as we then contemplate, we realize that after all, it lacks a self, it lacks an essence. All there is just no self. And thus, this careful analysis or dhatu vavatana, so analysis in terms of the elements, then leads to a shift in perception from my body to just elements and a sense of an absence of a self. And the Buddha has given. No, actually, what was that? Venerable Buddha Gosa, the famous commentator who compiled the Visuddhimagga, has given a wonderful explanation to an illustration that the Buddha originally mentioned, namely that of a butcher and a cow. Now, a butcher who has reared a cow for several months and then finally goes to slaughter this cow. And so then he cuts it up into different pieces, and eventually he takes these pieces and he goes to some crossroads and then sells it as meat. So what we have here is, in this illustration, a shift in perception from from seeing it first as a cow, and then once it has been slaughtered and cut up, the butcher will see it as meat. So it is meat that that he is selling, and not the cow that he's selling. Likewise, as Vipassana or Satipatthana meditators, at first we relate to this body as as a compact unit, as making up our being. But then as we undergo this meditation practice, a clear shift in our perception or cognition takes place, and we no longer see it as a being or as a whole body, but rather consisting of or composed of those four primary elements. So that's a major change in perspective. And what this then also does is it helps us to decrease our attachment or our grasping to the body. And it helps to decrease our sense of self. Now, this content, I'm citing Venerable Analayo from his book Satipatthana. Contemplation of the four elements has thus the potential to lead to penetrative realization of the insubstantial and selfless nature of material reality. And so this contemplation, if carried to its fullest, may lead to the full realization of the Dhamma, namely full enlightenment. Now, let us explore some general aspects connected with the contemplation of the body, and in particular the purpose and various purposes and benefits of it. So, this contemplation of the body is said to bring into proper perspective our way of seeing and relating to the body. Now, under normal circumstances, we see our, especially when we're young and healthy, we see our own body as rather attractive. And so we see it as wonderful, and so we show it around to others, and so and we want others to get interested in it. Isn't it that way? And so
we even do that when we're old.
Yes, that comment is correct. And so by undertaking this Kaya Navasana Satipatthana, we realize what we think is so attractive is in the end not all that attractive. And so the unattractive aspects of the body come more into the foreground than the attractive aspects of the body. Now, the Venerable Sayadaw Pandita, sometimes, when he speaks on Satipatthana, and certain people being infatuated with the body of another being, then ask the rhetorical question, what are you so terribly in love with? The head hair of that person, or the nose of that person, or with the one of the earlobes, or whatever else. And of course we can take it even further. And so there are many rather unpleasant aspects to this body of ours. And so Satipatthana meditation helps us, especially when we are mindful of all activities, to realize this. Now, the practice of the mindful contemplation of the body will also help us to understand another aspect, namely that this body is only the product of certain conditions. So what we experience physically has always some cause. So a strong pain arises, strong heat arises in the body, and we start sweating, and eventually we take some of our clothes off. Or it's very cold outside, the body starts shivering, and then we start putting on some extra clothes. Still along the same line, it's still cold, and the skin starts cracking. So these are all causal results. And so this particular aspect, the Buddha then explains further. And I'm quoting from a passage that occurs in many different places where it says on the human body. Now, this body made of material form, consisting of the four great elements, procreated by a mother and a father, and built up out of boiled rice and porridge, is subject to impermanence, to being worn and rubbed away, to dissolution and disintegration. It should be regarded as impermanent, as suffering, as a disease, as a tumor, as a dart, a calamity, as an affliction, as alien, as disintegrating, as void, as non-self. When one regards this body thus, one abandons desire for the body, affection for the body, and subservience to the body. So this makes things a little bit clearer. Now, furthermore, we tend to be, as Sudhna mentioned earlier on, we tend to be terribly infatuated with the body. And Sudhna Son, this continuous mindful contemplation of the body helps us to then see things according to reality, and with this then also our infatuation with the body will decrease to some extent. And with this comes another benefit, namely, we're less concerned about the body. So whether the body is aching a little bit or not, it doesn't matter. As a seasoned meditator, we know, oh well, it's just another phenomenon, these two will pass, what to worry about, let me just observe it. Thus, being less concerned with the body, less occupied with it, it is indeed a venue or a possibility that leads to the development of more and more concentration. So the answer given earlier on, this mindful contemplation of the body will help or be helpful for the development of deep concentration. So the mind is less certainly distracted or unhindered by sensual distractions. Now, this mindful contemplation of the body, it is said, can be the basis for the development of samatha meditation, and as part of samatha, even some psychic powers. But more important than this, it certainly can then also lead a meditator on to the mindful contemplation of feelings of the mind and of dhammas. So, mindful contemplation of the body is an important aspect when it certainly comes to the realization of the Dhamma. And it is actually said that this mindful contemplation of the body can take us all the way to the attainment or to the destruction of the taints or moral intoxicants. And the Buddha has spoken to this, as is recorded in Dhammapada verse 293, where it says, in those who always make a good effort in meditating on the body, who do not do what should not be done, but always do what should be done, who are also mindful and endowed with clear comprehension, moral intoxicants, the so-called asavas or taints or corruptions, come to an end. And the destruction of those taints comes only with the attainment of full realization, namely of arahantship. Now, this then shows you the potential of Kayanupassana Satipatthana. So, if we want to, theoretically, we could do, we could concentrate only on the mindful contemplation of bodily formations, and this would lead us to the final goal. Now, in the Majjhima Nikaya, in at least two places, it is said that this mindful contemplation of the body also acts as a crucial factor for withstanding the tempting forces of Mara. And Mara stands for unwholesome mental states such as greed, hatred, and fear, and fame, and so on. craving for name and certain fame. Now, one point that I left out early on in our discussion about the contemplation of the body under the aspects of seeing the elements leading to non-self. Well, this helps very much, or helps the meditator very much, to eventually overcome this wrongful belief in the existence of a self, Atta Deity or Sakkaya Deity. Sakkaya Deity is the wrongful belief in a self, and Atta Deity is just the belief in a self. And so, as we undertake Gayan Upasana Satipatthana, at first, as a number of meditators have now realized through their own meditation, at first we see the rising and falling movement of the abdomen as my rising and falling, and pain as my pain, and some hardness as my hardness, and so on. But with some practice, after a couple of days, the same meditators will then state, no, it's just the rising and falling happening, just a process. It's not my pain, but it's just the pain. It's not my hardness, it's just hardness. And as one continues to meditate, this certain new way of seeing and relating to phenomena will be further intensified or further strengthened, until one eventually gains the path of stream entry, sotapatti magga, and with this wrongful belief in the existence of the self will be uprooted from the mind once and forever. So that's an important point. And the mindful contemplation of the body is said to bring about yet a further major benefit, namely in the form of tethering the mind to the predominant, tethering the mind to the body. Now, as you will know from your own meditation practice, the untrained mind has this obnoxious habit of continuously wandering off. You try to keep it on the rising and falling movement of the abdomen, and it will stay there for a few moments, and whenever the next opportunity arises, it will go off thinking about something else. Or you are trying to observe a pain, and then some louder sound arises, and the mind goes off paying attention to the sound. And so by undertaking this contemplation of some bodily formation, we gradually withdraw our attention from the external senses, from the sense doors, such as the eye door, the ear door, the nose door, and the tongue door, and so our attention goes primarily to the body door. And the same thing goes also for the mind door, when the mind goes in all sorts of memories or planning the future and so on. And this certain particular aspect of Satipatthana is compared to the taming of a calf. A farmer who has a young calf doesn't want it to remain wild. A young calf will be full of energy and jumping around and running around. And so what does a farmer do? He will get a rope, he will then tie the rope around the neck of the calf and then bring with him some strong wooden pole, and suddenly he will drive this, he or she will drive this pole into the ground, and then tie the calf with the help of the rope to the pole. With this, the radius of action of the calf will be tremendously limited. And then, after a couple of days of being tied down to a pole, what will the calf do? Well, calmly it will stay somewhere near the pole, and it will stop jumping around. And so the same thing happens with the mind's tendency of going to the different sense doors. Now, let me conclude today's Dhamma talk by wishing. By undertaking the contemplation of the body, Kaya Anupassana, Satipatthana, and the different aspects that are mentioned here under, may your meditation develop through the different insight knowledges, and may it eventually, as proposed by the Buddha himself, lead all of us to the full realization of the Dhamma. And this is it for tonight. Now, do you have any questions or comments? Yes, Nicola.
I'm curious about how Mahati Sayadaw came to focus on the rising and falling, to pioneer that, and how and why.
Because he himself practiced with the so-called Mula Mingon Sayadaw, the root Mingon Sayadaw, and who lived in Tatong, which is in the south of Burma, and it was this Sayadaw, this Burmese monk, who had developed this observation of the rising and falling of the abdomen. And then taught this to Mahasi Sayadaw, and Mahasi Sayadaw himself found it to be very valuable. It worked for him, and then having gained good benefits from it, that's what he then taught others. And you'll find the same thing for other Vipassana teachers. A person like Sunun Sayadaw found that heavy breathing is worked very well for him. So at the beginning of a session, 45 minutes of hyperventilating. And if you like to, we're not going to try that here. You might even pass out. So for Sunun Sayadaw, 45 minutes of heavy breathing at the beginning of a session would work or lead to very good results, and he would then go on sitting until all the so-called unpleasant formations had subsided in the body. And so that sitting longer stretches, so like a minimum an hour and a half, sometimes even longer than that. And what worked for him, he then taught to others. And in the case of Mogok Sayadaw, another Burmese famous meditation master, he concentrated his approach to the meditation on the Paticca Samuppada Upada, so dependent origination. And so that undertaking the practice from under this aspect, seeing the cause of links between the objects, and so well, it worked for him, and so that's what he taught others. So there seems to be a tendency among meditation famous or founders of meditation or schools of meditation to teach that what has what they found to be useful for themselves. Does this answer your question?
Yeah, so it wasn't Mahasi Sayadaw himself who shifted away from inhale, exhale into the rising, falling. It was actually his teacher.
Yeah, right. Plus, Mahasi Sayadaw, justified the observation of the rising and falling movement of the abdomen over the in and out breathing in the following way by saying that the rising and falling movement of the abdomen as an object is coarser than the observation of or taking the in and out breathing as an object, and thus easier to observe. And not.
Yes. From spiritual life, I was drawn to Buddhism because of its extraordinary commitment to nonviolence. But I was disturbed along the way to learn of the enlistment of Buddhism in Japanese fascism and the inefficacy of Buddhism to protect the people of Cambodia. And I wonder, how does the practice protect itself against a baneful antagonism toward the body? Is metta the solution to that problem? In other words, if we are cognizant of the body as a kind of bag of chemicals, does it not become easy to do harm to it?
So there are various aspects to your questions there. What you're pointing at, or what you're pointing out, Buddhism being somewhat involved in Japanese fascism, yes, indeed. And actually, we can go even further in saying that, if I'm not mistaken, the 10th, 11th, and 12th, or 12th to 14th century, there in Japan, there were the so-called warrior monks, monastics who would even take a weapon and then in an organized manner attack another monastery or attack the local prefecture and so on. Now these are regrettable aspects in the history of Buddhism. And Venerable Narada Thera, in his book, What the Buddha, Walpula Rahula or Narada Thera. I think it's Rahula, Walpula Rahula. In his book, What the Buddha Taught, boldly declares at the beginning that no drop of blood has been shed in the name of Buddhism. This modern research into Buddhists or into the history of Buddhism in different countries now proves to be a somewhat superficial statement. There have been, unfortunately, cases where Buddhism wasn't all that non-violent. But nonetheless, as a whole, it's still a pretty non-violent or peaceful religion. Now, when it comes to your remarks about Cambodia, during the 4 years of the rule of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia, how was it? And I think 2 million people were killed out of a population of 4 million, and among them even many, many monastics. And so, I guess, outside at the time, outside countries just didn't have much leverage, to interfere with what was going on in Cambodia, and as far as I know, the Khmer Rouge were extremely brutal when it came to killing Cambodians, including the monastics. And so any kind of resistance, apparently, resistance to the Cambodian or to the rule of the Khmer Rouge, was apparently strongly suppressed. And so, then, as for the last part of your comment, the notion about the body, it's not that are led to kind of neglect the body. It's more in the sense of seeing and relating to the body in a more realistic manner. And so not making such a big deal out of this body, however, yet caring about it. And so, see, when it comes to reflections on food and taking food, we are encouraged to take food with an aim to nourish, to sustain this body, and in particular to sustain it for our spiritual work, and not to disregard it. And keep in mind that the Buddha himself had engaged in extreme forms of practices such as asceticism and or austere practices like fasting and so on, and he himself found that this is not working, and so he did not recommend this. And then on the positive side, we have, when you think of what we recite every morning, the metta chanting, Ahamaviruhomi, and then the last line, may I take care of my body happily. What this means, may I look after this body and get it out of bed happily, and then to move it to the bathroom happily, and and then shower it and dress it and feed it and move the balls and then walk it or exercise it and so on and so forth. And so, there is a fair concern that the concern for the Buddha, sorry, a fair concern for the body that the Buddha expresses. No. So it's not necessarily really promoting neglecting our body. No, and in actuality, have you been to India?
No.
No? Well, if you were to go to India, then you would see, but you can also see in videos and elsewhere, the forms that Hinduism sometimes takes, like sadhus practicing forms of ascetic practices, and part of this is sometimes eating very little or exposing the body to the heat of a fire, going as close as possible, and then smearing the body with all sorts of colors and dust and what not. So in comparison to that, in the Buddhist world, you don't find anything like this. And so in comparison to that, in Buddhism there's a fair regard for the body. No? So, then, anything else? Yes, Stephen.
I'm very interested in what you said about the movement of the breath, the movement of the abdomen, following that as movement, as the wind element. And it makes me think about whether one sees movement as a thing, as an element, or whether it is, as in your story about Ananda, a series of positions, like the difference between analog and digital, that whether, for instance, when walking, you know, I lift my foot, and the foot is lifted, or whether it is always the wind element, or in a sense, the two ways it would seem to me to look at it, one that it's movement, and the other is that it's a series of disappearances.
Ah, not so bad. Yeah, no. It's a series of movements. So let's take one movement such as the gliding movement of the foot. No, then upon superficial observation of this gliding movement, we may find it to be one continuous movement. However, with the mindfulness well developed, we will find that it's actually not just one continuous movement, but a series of smaller movements, sometimes tiny little movements, one after the other. And at one particular point, during one of the insight knowledges, a meditator will clearly see the dissolution of each of those segments or smaller movements. So, what appears that on the surface to be one continuous movement, upon closer observation, turns out to be different, and can be seen again in a different way. At one point, at an earlier point in the meditation practice, a meditator will see objects and including movements as quickly coming, going, coming, going, coming, going. So there's different ways of seeing things. No. And so in the meditation practice, just in general, our perception of the world, our perception of the mind, of the body, changes a great deal. There's our ordinary way of seeing this body and mind and seeing the world, and then apart from this, there are many other ways of seeing things. And as you go along in your meditation practice, you'll gradually then discover this for yourself. No? So there was one last question. Yes, over there. John.
The disappearance of the body in meditation, at least for me, is a very joyful experience. But at the same time, it brings on a dual problem of wanting to cling to the meditation where the body disappears, and then the aversion of having to come back to the body that you're trying to see through to begin with. And it's how do you deal with that? It would seem natural to want to cling to that joyful experience of having the meditation without the body. And how do you deal with having to come back to this body that, you're trying to get away from to begin with?
Well, the answer, the answer to this, again, lies in mindfulness. So, when there's enjoyment in getting away from this body, when, for instance, the boundary of the body falls away, the shape, contour of the body falls away, and if some aversion arises when the sense of body comes back, then just be mindful of that too. And maybe one more point. Or elaboration. In the context of the meditation practice, we experience a transition from seeing seeing the body as consisting of many different sensations and having a clear boundary or outline. Now, in the course of the meditation practice, this changes, the boundary changes, and at times it's partly there and partly not there, and later on it will disappear altogether. And at that point we'll realize, even earlier we might already realize, the shape or form or boundary of the body is just a concept, and it's not ultimate reality. And formations themselves, like pains and aches and rising and falling and so on, those stand for ultimate reality. They really exist, and they can't be reduced any further. So in this process, when sometimes the sense of the body falls away, then just accept it, just be mindful of it. And when at other times the sense of the body comes back, then again just accept that and be mindful of that. And if in that connection, joy arises or aversion arises, be mindful of it. Does this answer your question?
It answers it, yeah. It's easier said than done.
Yes, indeed. Okay, maybe this much for tonight. If there's any leftover question from today, then let's keep it for tomorrow.